Introducing WonderSuite from Bluehost.com, the tool that makes WordPress wonderful for everyone. Website creation is hard, but now with Bluehost, you can answer a few simple questions about your business and goals, and the WonderSuite tools will automatically lay out your WordPress website or store in minutes. Seriously. From there, you can customize your design, pick your brand colors, and add blocks. No custom theme or coding required. You'll get content suggestions that you can keep or revise. And with Yoast SEO built in, we automatically help you get found in search engines. From step-by-step guidance to suggested plugins to an AI-powered help bot, our built-in tools make WordPress wonderful for everyone. Whether you're a beginner or a pro, you can join over 2 million Bluehost users. Go to bluehost.com/wondersuite. That's bluehost.com/wondersuite.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Welcome to the Broken System Podcast. I'm your host, Robert, and joining me is my insightful co-host, Lexi. Together, we're here to uncover the flaws and challenges within our justice system, where fairness and equality often fall short.
In this podcast, we aim to delve into the complexities of our justice system and explore the experiences and perspectives of those who have been affected by its shortcomings. We'll dive deep into the stories of individuals who have faced injustice and examine the systematic issues that perpetuate the broken system.
Our goal is to bring awareness to the disparities and biases that exist within our justice system and to inspire our listeners to take action. Through thought-provoking discussions, interviews, and analysis, we'll explore the various aspects of the broken system and seek to understand how it can be reformed.
We believe that by shining a light on these issues, we can empower our listeners to become advocates for change. We'll discuss potential solutions, highlight success stories, and provide resources for those who want to make a difference.
So whether you're a concerned citizen, a legal professional, or simply someone who wants to learn more about the flaws in our justice system, we invite you to join us on this journey. Together, let's challenge the broken system, amplify unheard voices, and work towards a more just and equitable future.
Get ready to explore the depths of our justice system like never before. This is the Broken System Podcast.
This content is not suitable for children, as it may contain material or themes that are intended for a mature audience. Additionally, it is important to emphasize that individuals are presumed innocent until proven guilty in the court of law, and judgments should be reserved until a fair and impartial legal process has taken place.
The views and opinions expressed by guests on the Broken System Podcast are entirely their own and do not necessarily represent the perspectives, opinions, or positions of the hosts or contributors.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Broken System Podcast. I'm your host, Robert, and joining me, as always, is my co-host, Lexi. This week, we speak on the case of Jacob Landine. We talk with his brother, Eric, who is not only a friend of ours, but also just a good human being all around. On April 9th, 1987, Jacob was rushed to the hospital with supposedly have stopped breathing. And from that point on, Eric, his brother Jacob's life, and his mother's life changed forever. Jacob died in surgery on April 10th, 1987. Jacob's mom's boyfriend rushed into her work and told her that Jacob had stopped breathing and had to be rushed to the hospital. Once at the hospital, they ended up life-flighting Jacob to a different hospital. He had to have emergency surgery to repair a fresh skull fracture, likely as a result from blunt force trauma, possibly a wound from an open hand. In the early morning hours of April 10, 1987, Jacob died during the surgery. Later that day, an autopsy was performed. It was concluded that Jacob died of a subdural hematoma. Jacob's injuries were consistent with the repeated episodes of child abuse. There was evidence of an old, previously healed subdural hematoma, as well as a partially healed skull fracture and healing fracture of the fifth rib. Additionally, there was slight trauma found on Jacob's bottom. The manner of death was undetermined. This was a moment that would change Eric's life forever. Eric has spent the last 37 years fighting for justice for Jacob. He's done everything that he possibly could, fought every battle, talked to every person in the state of New Mexico, and he's still not been able to get the results. Earlier last year, there was great developments in the case. He thought he was going to get some help from the Attorney General's office, but that didn't happen. He found out about that earlier this year. Since then, he's revigorized his crusade and is working hard to get justice for Jacob. This week we talked to him, and once again, he's a great person and just really has been very important to me in the true crime world and has helped me, and he's just, I call him a friend. So I'm going to just get into it. This is a little bit longer of an episode, but it needs to be. Once again, this is 37 years ago today that Jacob lost his life. Hey, Eric, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good.
We are doing great. Thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it very much. We love you, and we want to have you on to, one, share your story, share Jacob's story, and just to get the world understanding what's going on and have another group of individuals fighting for you and fighting for Jacob. So, you know, we're here. We want to support you, and we want you to tell us your story. Tell us Jacob's story, and we're going to chime in as we see fit, but we want you to tell the story.
Sure. If you've heard the story before, I apologize in advance, but I do think there's a lot of stuff that has to be said about Jacob and in order to tell his story. So Jacob was born on July 1st, 1986. And my family was very religious growing up. My dad was a Pentecostal evangelist. Think about tents and like driving out into the country and setting up a tent and having church. That's what my dad did. And my mom was a stay-at-home mom taking care of myself. And before my brother was born, it was just me. But then after my brother was born, it was both of us. So as part of my prayers every night, I used to pray for a baby brother. And I really wanted a sibling. My parents were having trouble. They were having difficulty in their relationship. But I was like 4 years old and I didn't really know better. And so I was putting a lot of pressure on my parents to give me a brother. And the problem was my dad was just not really around a lot. He would go and preach and be on the road, but he wasn't mindful of the fact that he had a family at home. So there were times where my mom and I would be uncertain where our next meal was going to come from or if we were going to eat at all. My mom couldn't really work because she had young kids at home. So I just have to say that to paint the picture of where my mom's emotional state is at this point. So Jacob was born, like I said. When I found out my mom was pregnant, I remember I was super excited. I was learning how to ride my bike, and I'd finally been not afraid of trying to ride my bike without training wheels. I had crashed into a bush at a park. And so I was like crying and being dramatic, which is something that I still am today. And my parents knelt down by me to tell me that my mom was pregnant. And I completely forgot about my scraped knee and I started running around the park screaming, jumping up and down. I was so excited. And then, like I said, my parents were struggling and my mom found out that my dad was having an emotional affair with another woman. I don't believe that it was physical, but that's at least what we believe, that it was an emotional connection.
Mm-hmm.
So for my mom, like, that was like the ultimate betrayal for her. She's at home taking care of these two young kids. She is struggling to make ends meet, trying to manage the household without income, without any interaction or input from my dad. And so she decides that we need to leave and move back to New Mexico, because we were living in Texas at the time, because that's where my family was and my mom's family could help watch the kids. So my mom could work and take care of us and make sure that we had food and she wouldn't have to be like so stressed out. So we packed everything up and we left. And I remember I was very upset about this. I didn't really understand like why my parents were getting separated. But we get back to New Mexico. My mom puts me in kindergarten. She has Jacob with my grandmother whenever she's working, or with my aunt sometimes. And my dad's best friend, Steven, starts coming around my mom. And my mom is in this very vulnerable mindset. Like, she just left her husband. She just moved back home. She's living with her parents. She's got her kids with her. She's trying to work. She's trying to get her life situated. And he knew all about the situation because he was my dad's best friend. So Steven is somebody that my family knows very well. His family and my family are very close through marriages, through different things. Like, his aunt is my godmother. His sister married my mom's brother. His dad married my parents. Actually, his dad married me in my first marriage too. That should have been a sign. So like, all of that was actually an accident. It's not pertinent to this story, but I'll tell you at a different time.
Okay.
Anyway, this person wasn't a stranger. There's a reason why I was going down that list. He wasn't a stranger. My mom grew up with him. My family went to his church. My mom went to school with him. They'd known each other their whole lives. It's important to know that, because I think that sometimes people get the idea that this was just some random person, and he really wasn't. He was also somebody that everybody knows as happy and fun and friendly and charismatic.
Mm-hmm.
People really like him. He makes friends really fast. Anyway, he starts really trying to woo my mom into being in a relationship with him. And he starts to love bomb her and love bomb me, which is basically just showering people with affection and gifts and love in order to disarm them so that they will fall for you and get sucked into kind of like your plan, which is ultimately this person's plan. Steven's plan was to victimize my mom and me and Jacob. My mom is really not interested. She's trying to get her life together, and he's just persistent. Like, he is showing up at my grandparents' house. He's writing her notes. He's really just trying to get in her good graces. He keeps telling her stuff like, if you need a babysitter, like, I can babysit for you. Which, he's not even her boyfriend at this point, which is really weird. So he's constantly just trying to offer to help her. Oh, you guys should move in with me, and there's no pressure here. You can just live with me and you won't have to pay rent, and you can get your life together, but you won't have to live with your parents. And just constantly just trying to get my mom to be with him. And I think on some level, my mom was feeling a little bit vindictive towards my dad and felt like she maybe did want to get back at him. And so she did end up starting to see Steven. They started to see each other, and that's when he really ramps up his love bombing. That's when you really start to see him going above and beyond to just bend over backwards for whatever I wanted, whatever my mom wanted. If I wanted to go see like the monster trucks, a couple $100, he would take me just on a whim. So I thought this guy was great. Like, he let me watch Terminator with him. And that movie was scary when I was like 5 years old. At the same time, like, you know, things start moving pretty quickly in my mom and his relationship. I don't know that we're necessarily living with him at this point. We might be. I definitely know that we were at his place a lot. so it felt like we were. But Jacob starts to have injuries that are unexplainable. And Jacob's personality, he had a big personality at a very young age. Like he was fearless. My mom calls him a daredevil. He liked to do crazy things. Like he liked to pull all of the drawers out of the kitchen and like cutlery would be flying all around. And this is 1987. There's no baby proofing at this point. Like
there's no such thing as child proof.
Yeah. Everything was dangerous. The 80s were very dangerous. I have several scars because of standing up in the front seat of my dad's car while he's driving without a car seatbelt. There was, you know, none of that.
Yep.
He would do things like that. He also had this baby swing that he would reach forward when it swung forward and grab the front legs. And he threw the whole thing back one time and started laughing. He thought it was hilarious. He laughed like Eddie Murphy. He did this little, I've never heard anybody other than Eddie Murphy laugh like that. It was wild. He was a wild child and fearless. And his behavior started to change. He started to be very afraid of things that he wasn't normally afraid of. And in the midst of all this, Stephen's telling my grandmother and my mom that I'm jealous of Jacob, that every time I go by Jacob, that I hit him, that I kick him. And Stephen at this point is somebody that everybody likes, somebody that people believe and have faith in and trust. And Jacob had a skull fracture that led to a hematoma that had to be lanced and drained. And Stephen said that he had left me alone with Jacob so that he could take his kids to his ex-wife's house. I was 5 years old and Jacob was like 6 months old. And so if that story is true,
he's still in the wrong.
That's completely insane. Nobody should ever leave a five-year-old in charge of an infant, ever, under any circumstances. His story was that I picked Jacob out of his crib and dropped him on his head, and that's how he got his skull fracture. And the crib was really tall. I think with the rails up, it was probably at least 5 feet tall. It might have been more than that, but it was at least 5 foot tall. So I'm not saying that it's impossible for me to get Jacob out of there. It just would have been very difficult. I would have probably had to have taken a chair from the kitchen, pushed it into the room, stood on top of the chair, picked Jacob up, and trying to get this kid up out of that crib would have been very difficult for me because Jacob was 10 pounds when he was born. He was probably like at least 20 pounds at this point. And I was small. I was very small for my age and light. So I'm not saying it's not possible. I don't remember this happening, but that was his story. So my mom starts to get worried about Jacob and about me and about what's going on. And the doctor had said something about child abuse but said that my mom didn't seem like she was abusive. He actually called Child Protective Services, the doctor did, and they did open an investigation. According to the state police record, the investigation didn't go anywhere because Stephen chased the CPS worker away and told her to get off of his property.
Wow.
So nothing happened. My mom decides to send me to California, where my dad is now living, to just put some distance between me and Jacob. If I am hurting him, then hopefully it'll stop. But if I'm not, then she can hopefully get to the bottom of what's going on. And I go to California. I get disenrolled in New Mexico, and I get enrolled in a kindergarten in California. And the injuries to Jacob don't stop. They keep happening. And so my mom really starts to limit how much time that Jacob is alone with Stephen. And there's one night where Jacob is still healing from his last skull fracture. And he's been fussy. He's had an ear infection. He had an allergic reaction to some medication they gave him for the ear infection. So he just wasn't feeling good. He was still healing. And my grandmother wanted to go to church. This is on April 9th, 1987. And so she calls my mom and asks my mom, what do I do? And Jacob's not feeling good. I don't want to take him to church, but I really want to go. My mom said, I guess you can take him to Stephen. I'm getting off in an hour. We're going to go see this trailer, this mobile home. And in her mind, she's thinking, what's the worst that could happen in an hour? As soon as she gets off the phone with Stephen or with my grandma, she goes to her boss and asks to leave early. And she just has a bad feeling. She doesn't know why. Her boss told her no, that it was busy and that she had to stay and finish working. So my mom started making herself busy so that she wouldn't think about it. And a little bit under an hour, Stephen comes running into the supermart where my mom worked in a panic. And he is telling my mom that Jacob is unconscious. And at the same time, there's an ambulance driving by and it's got Jacob in it and they're rushing him to the hospital. Jacob's injuries were so severe that he had to be life flighted to Albuquerque, which is 75 miles away from Socorro, where this was happening. He arrived in Albuquerque much faster than my mom did because she had to drive with Stephen and my grandparents. And when they get Jacob to the University of New Mexico Hospital, they do some x-rays, they do a CAT scan, and the doctor sees that Jacob's having some brain swelling and some fluid building up on his brain. And so he decides to do an emergency surgery to relieve the pressure on Jacob's brain. And he signed off on it because my mom wasn't there yet, and he deemed that it was urgent enough that he had to do that without her permission. Jacob died on the operating table in the early morning hours of April 10th, 1987.
I'm so sorry.
The whole time that they're driving up to Albuquerque, Stephen is telling my mom, I swear I didn't hit him. I swear I didn't hit him. This didn't happen on purpose. He's just constantly just saying this stuff over and over. When they get to the hospital in Albuquerque, the doctor has a strange interaction with Stephen. He comes out to tell my mom that Jacob died, and my mom runs away in hysterics. And Stephen looks at the doctor and says, "This doesn't look good for me. This looks really bad for me." And the doctor thought that was so strange that he actually wrote it down in his notes and made sure to mention it to the police. I think it's very strange as well that his reaction wouldn't be to comfort my mom or to have some kind of other emotional reaction other than worrying about himself and how it looks for him. But what do I know?
No, I think anybody that looks at that's the oddest behavior, especially after driving in the car, defending himself the whole time without any care other than himself.
I would imagine too, just that car ride for obvious reasons would have been incredibly stressful. And then spend the whole time to just only care about yourself and not really have the sense or compassion to be like, oh, there's other people in this car who are going to be hurting much more than me in this situation, and just not caring about that.
No, it was, and that's the thing that we see as a pattern with him throughout this story, is he's always concerned with how he appears to everybody else. That is like the utmost importance in his mind, and it is the only thing that matters to him. So that tells you a lot about who he is as a person.
Yep.
So the state police begin an investigation into the case because Jacob died in Albuquerque, even though he was from Socorro, and they start interviewing everybody. And Stephen's story changes a few times as like the case evolves. But the first story that he gave is he said that he had been living with my mom since December of 1986 or January of 87. He was employed as a maintenance man for the county of Socorro. So just remember that. He told Agent DeWalt that my grandmother, Merlinda, brought Jacob to him at approximately 6 p.m. on Thursday, April 9th, 1987. Mr. Chavez stated that Mrs. Landin was going to look at a trailer after she got off work, that the trailer did not have electricity, and that they needed to look at it before it got dark. Mrs. Landin, my mom, had reportedly asked her mother to bring Jacob to Mr. Chavez so she would not have to make the trip to pick Jacob up. Jacob seemed to be feeling all right, and Mr. Chavez put him in his walker and gave him a teething cookie and his bottle. Mr. Chavez was on the floor dubbing some cassette tapes for his brother. And so if you don't know what that means, back in the day, you used to be able to copy one cassette to another. And it didn't matter if it was like made by Sony. You could still do it. It was the OG pirating. And so that's what he's talking about, is copying. He was making a mixtape for his brother. So just in case you don't know that. Jacob was playing in the living room in his walker. One of the wheels on the walker kept getting stuck in the box, which contained the tapes. Mr. Chavez stated that he moved Jacob away from the tapes, but Jacob wanted to keep playing with them. He took Jacob out of the walker and placed Jacob on the floor behind himself as he was lying on the floor with his head propped up with one of his hands. He had given Jacob two or three old tapes to play with, his teething cracker and his bottle. After playing on the floor for a while, Jacob became sleepy. He stated that he picked Jacob up and was carrying him to the bedroom when the tape clicked. So he put him on the couch, which changed the tape, heard Jacob make a noise, and that's when he turned around to see Jacob lying on the floor between the couch and the coffee table. So he's claiming that he set Jacob on the coffee table. He turned around because the tape clicked, and Jacob fell, hit his head on the coffee table, and then was lying between the coffee table and the couch. It's important to know that the report of the medical investigator said that on the CAT scan, you could see what looked like, he said it was blunt force trauma, but you could see some like the imprint of basically the open hand of an adult male on the top of his head. So he told this story to the doctor too. And the doctor told him that there's no way that what he was describing is what caused the injury that Jacob had on his head. So the doctor doesn't believe him. So he changes the story again later with another police officer and talks about, for some reason, he's playing with his beard in between Jacob's legs. I don't know why, but he says that's what he's doing. And he feels Jacob losing his balance. So he like grabs him and overcorrects, and Jacob hits an armchair. But again, that would not match the injury that he described. He changed his story about four more times, and I'm not going to go into all of them, but it's just, it tells me a lot that, first of all, he's only concerned with himself. Then he changes his story multiple times, depending on who he's talking to or when he's talking to them. So there's no way to know what, if anything, in his story is true. The only consistent thing that he does have in all of his stories is the fact that he was making a cassette tape for his brother. So that's
the one detail.
That's probably the one truth.
I was going to say, it's easier to tell the truth than it is to lie. And that's the one consistent thing he's doing, is he's making a mixtape.
Yeah. Yeah. There's all the speculation about me that's being tossed around by Steven, and my mom and my grandma are talking about it as well. It's difficult because, so I get called in the middle, or my dad gets called in the middle of the night, and he finds out about Jacob. And so we get on a plane at 5 or 6 in the morning, go back to Albuquerque, and immediately I'm taken into questioning by the agent Sue DeWalt. And she starts asking me questions like, does Steven ever hit you? And I say, no, but he always acts like he's going to. And then she asked me if I ever kicked or hit Jacob. And I said that I pulled his hair and I pinched him, but that I never kicked him. And they asked me why. And I said, because my dad told me if somebody hurts you, you hit them back. Very normal little boy logic.
Yeah, a child.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They go through that whole thing. They talk to my grandmother. They talk to everybody. There was an anonymous complaint that was made by a neighbor at some point saying that my mom's boyfriend was hitting Jacob. I don't know who the neighbor was, and I don't know what they saw or what they heard, but it makes me believe that they had to have, something had to have happened for them to call and make a report.
Yeah, it just doesn't line up. There's no reason for them to call and then all of these things happening outside of that. It would be too much of a coincidence for them just to call.
Yeah. Essentially, what happens is this investigation continues. Steven is pulled in several times, not just with state police, but also with local Socorro police, and questioned repeatedly. And then, I don't know, he's trying to convince my mom that it's an accident. He keeps telling her that he wants to talk to her, that he wants to talk to her at Jacob's grave. For some reason, my mom never went to meet him there, but he's just being very persistent. He's leaving notes on her car. He's calling her at work. He's leaving notes with her boss at work. He's calling my grandma's house. He's calling my aunt's house. He's like reaching out to anybody that can get in front of my mom to try to get her to talk to him. And so sometime around July, he comes to my mom and says, I'm going to prove to you once and for all that I'm being honest and that I didn't do this on purpose. So I want you to go with me because I have to go do a polygraph in Santa Fe. So we all go up there and he's being polygraphed for several hours. He walks out of the state police building and my mom asks him, how did it go? He said, it went great. I passed. And we believed him because he walked out like he was free to go. 1987, that probably would have been enough for them to keep him there.
Yeah, you would think.
But so we thought, yeah, he must be telling the truth. It must have been an accident because he clearly passed this test. And then he starts to do this thing where he's like, oh, by the way, Brenda, I applied for all this credit and I put you down as my wife. And I also signed you up for health insurance and Eric up for health insurance with the county and said that you're my wife. So you're going to have to marry me because I just committed fraud and I'm going to go to prison if you don't.
Which is crazy.
Yeah. But this is also pre-internet. So keep that in mind. Mm-hmm. There was no way to Google any of the laws. So even if that wasn't true or was true at the time, it really doesn't matter. My mom would not have known and would not have been able to find out very easily. So she agrees to marry him. And that's when we get to meet the real Steven. And he becomes very violent with my mom. He has a very short fuse. Yeah, anything that we did would have set him off, even if it was just like chewing my food or whatever. It didn't matter what it was. He would just fly off the handle and start beating my mom. And it was scary. It was terrifying to have that going on every day. I used to be locked up in my room for a long time. If I needed the restroom, he would usually be listening to music really loud. And so I would have to knock on my door to see if I could be let out to use the restroom. And most of the time he wouldn't hear me. So I would just have to use the restroom in my room. I used to sleep with a kitchen knife, a can of hairspray, and a lighter under my pillow. I had a baseball bat under my bed just in case I had to defend myself in the middle of the night. Everything. There would be times where he would beat my mom so badly. And every time that happened, we would have to come up with a story together that would protect his image. And he would drill us on it over and over until he felt like we were convincing enough before we could even go out in public after he would beat her. And so he would tell us that if we got it wrong, that my mom was going to get it worse when we got home. So we all did, we being his kids and I, all did what he said. He sexually abused me and told me that if I said anything, that he would kill me and my mom and that nobody would ever find our bodies.
That's horrible. I'm so sorry.
And I didn't tell anybody. Because I didn't want my mom to die. I wanted to die.
I'm sorry. He's just just the worst.
But he made a big mistake.
Yeah.
He was trying to groom my 14-year-old cousin so that he could sexually abuse her. He would call her, tell her that she's beautiful and that he wants to be with her and that he wants to leave my mom for her. He wants to take care of her. But she can't tell anybody because nobody would understand. And he didn't know her very well, because if he would have known her, he would have known that she was not the right person to target in my family. She let him say everything he needed to say. She even egged him on a little bit so she could get him to say more and promised him that she wasn't going to say anything. And then as soon as she got off the phone, went and told my grandma everything. And so my mom talked to her, and there was like a level of self-abuse that my mom was going through where she felt like she on some level deserved what was happening to her because of what happened to Jacob. And I think that she felt, as long as it was only happening to her, that it would be okay. She found out about my cousin and she got the will and the fight to leave and did amazing. She handled it perfectly. She got us out of there while he was at work. We got everything, took it to my grandparents' house. And then she just told him the only place she was going to talk to him was at the police station. And so they talked there. And at this point, my mom's like, this guy for sure is capable of killing my baby, because he constantly told her the only way she was leaving him was in a body bag. He strangled her with a wire hanger. He held a knife to her throat. He burned all of her clothes and pushed her out into the street naked after he beat the shit out of her. Like, she went from thinking like, this person, she doesn't think he's capable. And the police asked her, do you think he's capable of hurting Jacob on purpose? She said, no, I don't think so. And now, after 3 years of torture, she's absolutely, I believe he's capable of killing somebody because he's shown me that he's capable of it. And so she goes to the police and I disclose my abuse to her. And so we go to the police. I file a police report. My mom files a police report. My cousin files a police report. Nothing happens.
And this is all in the town. That's all in the town of Socorro, right?
Yeah, Socorro.
Socorro.
Yeah, it's all here. He was friends with the police. They played basketball every weekend together.
It's amazing how that happens.
Yeah. He worked for the county. Like, yep. He was part of the city county basketball, whatever thing that they had going on. And they all hung out all the time. Every time the police were called, my mom was getting her ass kicked. Nobody did anything. They just laughed with him about how crazy women are. Nobody cared.
That's infuriating.
So when we go to disclose all this other abuse, nobody cares. My mom also says, I really want you guys to look into Jacob's death again, because now I'm convinced that he's capable of this. And I really want you to see what you can find out. they refuse to prosecute him. Telling my mom the reason they're not going to prosecute is because she gave him an alibi, which is something that continues to come up. It depends on who you talk to, but according to Juanita Gordon, who was an investigator for the DA at the time, she says that my mom saying that she doesn't think Stephen is capable of intentionally hurting Jacob is an alibi. It is not an alibi. That is a feel. That is a feeling. That is not something that is concrete at all, and is not anything that can be proven, because nobody can alibi this person. He was alone with Jacob.
But it's also coming from a state of mind that she was being mentally and physically abused by him, and maybe the physical abuse hadn't started yet, but he had been mentally abusing her and
emotionally too.
Emotionally in a way that, that she didn't know better. And it's unfair to take someone that's in that position. She was scared for herself at the time, and for you. And
it also seems like too that maybe this woman just simply doesn't know what the proper definition of an alibi is, and in her mind is like swapping it with a different term and just holding on to that definition.
I mean, because it is we all Socorro. Know
that's just not what it is. Yeah,
it is Socorro. So like that doesn't surprise me if that's the case, because our education system is not the best in New Mexico, and Socorro is definitely not the gold standard of the best of the worst. So I could definitely see that being an issue, but that's what they say. You alibied him, so we're not going to prosecute. And all the while, he is stalking us. He's coming to my bedroom every night, knocking on my window, telling me that he's going to kill me. He's going to kill my mom. And following us, driving around, following us. Going to my mom's work, sitting outside of her work and staring at her from his truck, just completely being menacing and scary.
Yeah.
Trying to intimidate.
Yeah. Yeah.
And stalking as it is, I just from my own knowledge of it from other podcasts and stuff, there's not a lot that people can do when they're in those situations. It takes often like they have to be in the most extreme situations. It seems like at this point you and your mom definitely were. But knowing that there was so much essentially working against you because he was in cahoots with the police, that it makes it hard to get something done.
Yeah.
Well, and then you throw it back that it's, what, 1990, 1991?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Those times, it wasn't. It's totally different now in how people view that type of stuff. But from what was acceptable in the late 80s and early 90s compared to now is so different. So
yeah,
it's just horrible.
It's true. My mom she does get order of protection, and even her marriage is annulled because of how violent it was. We start to do this thing where we are going to every new DA that comes through Socorro County and asking them to look into the case, to reopen the case. We don't get anywhere, really, until 2005, when we have the case reopened by the state police, the cold case unit, and they do probably one of the best investigations that's ever been done on this case. Detective Thomas Christian did a phenomenal job. I just want to read you his summary to the case, because I think it gives you like an idea, and then we can move into the like next part of this conversation if you want.
Okay.
Do you guys have time? Because that's
we're
time is yours, so all good.
Yep.
Okay, cool. Let's see here. I just gotta find where I'm at. Okay, here we go. Investigative conclusion. After an extensive review of the completed investigative reports, which included the autopsy reports, it is my opinion that the criminal charge of abandonment or abuse of a child, which resulted in the death of Jacob Landin, a first-degree felony in 1987, was justified and should have been pursued against Richard Stephen Chavez. Mr. Chavez was arrested in 1992 and charged with that offense. But after his arrest, it appears that nothing else occurred after the initial filing of the criminal charge. And I've been unable to determine why this occurred, as records no longer exist. There was sufficient evidence in this investigator's opinion to prove that Mr. Chavez knew of Jacob's recent head injury, which occurred several weeks before this incident. And this incident, which resulted in Jacob's death, Mr. Chavez should have been more attentive to Jacob's needs due to Jacob's recent head injury. In addition, Mr. Chavez had taken care of Jacob numerous times before this incident, so he was familiar with Jacob. In addition, he had prior experience with infants and small children, as he had, at that time, small children of his own from a previous marriage in which he still had physical contact with those children. Mr. Chavez did negligently and without justifiable cause place Jacob in a situation that endangered his life. Mr. Chavez knew of his prior injury, and combined with the fact that he changed his story or version of events during the investigation, which were not witnesses by anyone else several times, the fact alone draws a lot of suspicion to any story he tells after his initial statement. This incident, which resulted in Jacob's death, occurred one way, not the two or three ways told by Mr. Chavez. Mr. Chavez knew that he needed to be much more attentive to Jacob's needs, as Jacob was only 9 months old and still.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
In need of almost constant supervision. The recent head injury and Mr. Chavez had failed to do this. The problem with this investigation at this time is the statute of limitations, and in this investigator's opinion, if this is not overcome, there cannot be a successful criminal prosecution in this matter. We also have a speedy trial issue. Because he was arrested in 1992, it appears that the criminal charge was never pursued by the state. On Wednesday, October 6, 2005, he met with my mom and told her what he did with this investigation. So he referred the investigation to the DA at the time and said, I want you to look at this again because I think that you could still bring charges. And the DA said no, and he closed the case.
That is amazing to me. First of all, how he was arrested in the county.
Mm-hmm.
Charged, basically.
Yeah.
Released on bail or whatever. And then everything just disappeared. No resolution to it at all. And then There's no records of it because of the timing. And I wouldn't doubt it. There was a flood or, whatever.
There was a fire.
Yep.
There was a fire. And I'm not saying that I'm accusing anybody of anything, but it is convenient that a maintenance worker, aka janitor for the county, has keys to every building in the county.
Yeah.
I'm gonna leave that there.
Yep.
Yeah. So with all of that in mind, and thank you so much for sharing your story as well as Jacob's, how can people continue to support what you are doing for Jacob?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we haven't gotten to where we are right now, but obviously we're still trying to get justice, because I wouldn't be here doing this if it wasn't for that. So spoiler alert, if you're hanging on to the cliffhanger here, we don't have justice still. I need to get my life together, which is something that I constantly say. I need to make a new petition for the Attorney General, because the one I have is for the DA at the time in Socorro. And so that's something that I'm going to have soon and get, and we'll get to you guys to, if you can help me share that.
Absolutely.
Signing these petitions are really important. It's really important. It gets the attention of not just whatever agency people are trying to petition, but it also gets the attention of the media. And that can be a lifesaver in cases like Jacob's, where there's been, up until recently, very little coverage on his story. In fact, the local paper didn't even run anything beside his obituary when he was killed. Signing that petition is going to help us, because we're really trying to put pressure on the Attorney General to do a thorough investigation of this case. We're also going to be doing the 10 days of Jacob. So we'll be asking people to call, email, write to Raul Torres and his office at the Attorney General's office, asking him to do a proper investigation on this case. And I think those are the two big things that would help with Jacob's case right now.
And we'll definitely be a part of those and make sure that we're doing that through those 10 days for sure, if not more.
Thank you.
When does the 10 days start?
So April 1st through April 10th. So it'll end on the day that he died.
Okay. And that'll be the day that we release this episode, but we will start pushing this episode beginning that 1st of April. Okay. We'll start leading up to that. So we'll make sure to support that wholeheartedly every day. So one of the questions that I want to ask is, so the original investigation started in Albuquerque, correct?
Yeah.
And that was with the state police. Is there any reason why the state police didn't keep it the whole time, that it kept reverting back to the small town? And I know I'm going to say it wrong again, Sequoia?
Socorro.
Socorro.
Yeah.
Why it kept reverting back to Socorro?
So I think it has to do with the fact that I think because the abuse or alleged abuse happened in Socorro County, that Socorro County would be the one to bring forth the case of child abuse resulting in death. So it's not like he was killed in Albuquerque. He died in Albuquerque, but what happened to him happened in Socorro. So I think the state police were assisting the investigation, but they weren't leading it because they didn't necessarily have jurisdiction over Socorro County.
And the county would have to ask for their help or Correct. Give them jurisdiction to mm-hmm. for them to handle it. Okay. I just, yeah. I've wondered that. Okay. So the all through this time you're going through, so what drove you? So you've changed, you've always fought for Jacob, but yeah. now you're fighting for everyone, and fighting for your role in advocacy has grown because of your fight for Jacob. So tell us how that's developed and where you're at with that through this time.
Sure. Yeah. 2005, we have the case reopened and it is closed. We have all but given up basically on justice for Jacob at this point, because it just feels like impossible. The statute of limitations was a thing for second degree murder in New Mexico, especially for second degree murder negligently caused, which is what they would have charged him with, because they couldn't prove that he intended to hit Jacob or hurt Jacob. That was a real thing. That was a real issue that was impeding any potential litigation in this case. And thankfully, that statute was overturned, and also was the Supreme Court in the state of New Mexico said that the reversal was retroactive.
That's great.
Yeah, it was huge news for us. At the same time, there's all of these cases coming through the media in New Mexico of kids who are being killed by people who are supposed to be taking care of them. And we have some of the most horrific cases of child murder in the country. We've got Baby Brianna. We've got Victoria Martins, Omari Varela. There's countless kids, James Dunkley Cruz, who have been completely forgotten by the state of New Mexico. Our Child Protective Services is failing. There's no nice way to say that. It's failing. And every time they try to fix it, it's never enough. So I kept telling myself that I wish somebody would stand up and say something about it. I wish that somebody would talk about it. And I'm not like, I didn't come into podcasting being like, I want to be a podcaster. That's my dream. It was more of, okay, if nobody's going to say anything, maybe I can try to say something. Maybe I can do something about this. And so I created True Consequences podcast to highlight some of these stories, some of these cases that don't get a lot of coverage because it's a really poor state. And there's a lot of issues like the missing and murdered Indigenous women. We have some of the highest incidences of missing and murdered Indigenous persons in the country. And New Mexico has like this really unique set of challenges along with a very unique culture. And I felt like it was important to provide a platform for people to be able to share their stories and to do it in a way that's authentic to them and in a way that's meaningful to them and that honors their loved one. True crime can be salacious and it can be exploitive. It can be very damaging to cases sometimes. So I knew right away that I didn't want to do like that kind of true crime, but I was trying to fill out different styles in the beginning and trying to figure out what I was going to do. And I realized as I started talking to families that I could provide some sort of inspiration. It sounds arrogant. It's not meant that way.
No, I don't think so.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Hope is really important. It goes a long way, I think, when people are, for lack of a better word, like just stuck, I think, in trying to figure out what they can do next and all those things. And I think when you have someone who can provide hope or exposure, like it, and with the right intentions, it can mean a lot, I think. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I just wanted to like, I didn't want people to feel the way that my mom and I have been feeling for the last almost four decades. So that became my focus, was trying to help people tell their stories, doing some minimal editing just for clarity or just to clean up some things in the audio. And then also just letting families talk like as much as they wanted to.
Yeah.
I've had moms tell 3 hours worth of a story about their kid. And I think that's how it should be, right? This is their child. This is a huge part of their life and they're gone. And so I knew right away that I wanted to create content that was impactful, that made a difference in the lives of the people whose stories are being told. And so I did that and it grew and it's doing pretty well. It's helped a lot of families. There's been some good exposure that's come out of the show and has led to some tips and things coming forward, which has been awesome to see. But I still thank you. Yeah. I still found myself wanting to do more. I am not only dramatic, but I'm also like obsessively busy and I do it to myself all the time. I decided, okay, this is good. This is helping a little bit, but like I could do more. So I talked to my mom and we decided to create a nonprofit.
That's exciting.
Yep. And it's called Angels Voices Silenced No More. And it's in honor of Jacob. We are a granting organization. We grant funds to families in New Mexico who are fighting for justice or searching for their missing loved ones. We pay for things direct to vendor for like funeral expenses, therapy, private investigations, billboards, internet ads. Pretty much anything that they need to fight for justice or to get answers, search and rescue supplies, that kind of stuff. That's been really awesome. We're actually fundraising, going to start fundraising for 3 grants right now because we don't quite have enough to satisfy those grants, but we have awarded them. We just have to start raising some money for them. One of them's for funeral expenses. One of them's for a private investigator. And I think the third one was for some for reward money for tips.
And while we're talking about it, how can, if we want to donate and get you funds for those things, how can we do that?
You can go to angelsvoicesnm.org and you can find all the information that you need there, as well as how to donate. There's also merch that you can buy if you would like to get something in exchange for your donation. We've got some like really, I like it. I think it's fun. Stay caffeinated, fight for justice, or drink coffee, fight for justice, something like that. I don't remember what it says, but we've got some fun ones. So there's stuff like that. And then we're going to be doing a community baby shower in July on Jacob's birthday. We're going to be collecting donations for that. And we're going to be offering free baby items to mothers who are in domestic violence shelters, mothers who are unhoused, or mothers who just need help taking care of their babies and providing their babies what they need. We're doing that in Jacob's honor. That's going to be really awesome. So that's been cool and exciting. And then I also was like, I could do more still.
That's one more project.
So I actually co-founded a conference with my friends, Whitney and Melissa from Navigating Advocacy, called Advocacy Con. And the whole goal of that is to bring families of the missing and murdered together with experts and with nonprofits, and to provide them with resources that they may not be able to take advantage of normally, or they may not be able to connect with on their own, and put them together with them so that they can hopefully get their cases moving forward. We're also going to provide education. Sarah Turney is going to be there to talk about how to get media attention on your case, along with Julie Murray. So they're going to do like a joint panel conversation on that. That's going to be incredible. We've got Beth Holloway, Natalie Holloway's mom, coming to give a keynote address on hope for cases. Like it gets me so excited just thinking about what's going to happen in March of 2025 when we launch Advocacy Con, and how many people we're going to be able to help as we continue to do it every year and as it continues to grow. I'm super, super excited about it. And I hope to see both of you there.
I have my ticket already.
Yep.
Awesome.
I'm excited.
Yeah. I think that's so awesome. It's so important. I think it's easy when you're doing the work for other cases, especially if it's a podcast, like you're more knowledgeable about, like, oh, you should do X, Y, and Z, or reach out to this one. But I think for families who don't know that, it can be a really hard thing to navigate. Especially because there's people out there who don't do it for the right reasons, and that could be really complicated. And sometimes all it takes is being burned once in the wrong way, and it could really challenge things. But I think it's awesome that you're creating such a inspiring community of people who care for all the right reasons to want to make those necessary changes.
I'm trying.
And you're doing it good. And I think it's easier for, I don't want to say that, so, for someone that goes through what you've went through, to be able to give advice to other people that are going through the same thing, that advice comes easier to the people receiving it than it does coming from outside people that have never went through it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, there's an inherent trust there because nobody else understands. So to have somebody there that understands, it means more when they're saying, hey, I did this and it worked. As opposed to just somebody whose motives might be questionable advising you to do things. You might be a little bit more skeptical. And you're right, Lexi, there's no handbook for this. There's no manual. And so a lot of families are just making it up as they go. And I'd really like to take a lot of the guesswork out of that and a lot of the trial and error for them to teach some of the things that I've learned along the way, that Sarah Turney, Julie Murray, like a lot of these family advocates have learned along the way, of what to do and what not to do, who to trust and who not to trust. Those things are really important and really hard to navigate by yourself. So I think that's what excites me the most about Advocacy Con.
Awesome. Absolutely. And it's bringing such a big group of people together that has one goal in mind. And that's amazing to me.
Yeah, I'm excited. Can't wait.
Yep. And that's just, it's coming up on 1 year, right? And that's a year away, right?
Yes.
Which must be so exciting but terrifying at the same time. Of like, all things are getting really real.
Yeah, it's getting real, and I'm like, oh, I don't feel like I'm doing enough. I've got so much to do still.
You started planning this a year and a half, or a year ago, probably.
Yeah, about a year ago. Yeah.
So you're ahead of. There's so many people that do things like this that try to throw it together in 3 and 4 months. And
you can't.
I just don't see how you can do it and be successful at it. We applaud you very much for that. And we're excited for those things. And all of these things will be linked in our show so people can go and find those things out.
Awesome.
So now we're moving into where you're at now. So
yeah,
I'd like to move into the last couple years of Jacob's story.
Yeah.
And I know that's been a fight, and it's been a very frustrating battle for you, just knowing you and then seeing just the reactions and things. So I want to get it to our people.
You're talking about when I'm popping off on Twitter. Is that what you're
all of it? It's just like, I know that something has developed. When I see that come across Twitter, I'm like, oh no, poor Eric. Let me reach out and make sure everything's good. So let's get into those frustrations and the aggravations, and then what we can do to try to help for that.
Yeah, that sounds good. And I'm laughing and smiling because it's basically comical at this point. I've gone through the whole roller coaster of emotions with all of this. When we found out that the statute of limitations had been repealed, we reached out to the DA and didn't hear anything. And so I said, okay, I'm going to do a calling and writing campaign. And I did 10 Days of Jacob, which might sound familiar. We just talked about that. I'm doing it again. It worked the first time, so I'm hoping it'll work the second time. We had people calling from all around the world, emailing from all around the world, people in Australia, people in New Zealand, people in South Africa, people in the UK. It was incredible. It was amazing. I had people in Brazil emailing the DA in Socorro County and asking him to reopen the case. And so we started April 1st. We were going to go to April 10th. On April 2nd, the DA emailed me and said, can you please make this stop?
That's awesome.
And I said, happy to, but really would love to know where you landed. Like on the whole, are you opening the case or
are
not?
You going to do something about this, or you just want me to make it stop?
And so then after I fired that off, there was another email from him. And I saw that he had emailed the attorney general at the time and copied me and said, I can't handle this. I need you to take this case and do whatever you need to do with it. Hector Valderas was the attorney general at the time. And his office called a meeting with my mom and I. And Hector himself showed up. It was a virtual meeting because it was during COVID. And he apologized on behalf of the state of New Mexico for what happened with the initial investigation. That's the first time that anybody's ever acknowledged the injustice that occurred, not just definitely with Jacob, but also with my mom and with me and with anybody else that has been hurt since Jacob died. And so, like, we had a lot of hope. He told us that he couldn't promise that he was going to solve the case or be able to bring charges, but that he was going to do everything he could and everything in his power to give this a thorough investigation. So we believed him. And I think that had he still been in office, we probably would have seen a thorough investigation. But in that moment, we had a lot of hope. This is the first time somebody's actually said that they're going to try to see if they can bring charges against this monster. And I decided to pull back on the giant push for media that I was doing at the time to give space for the investigation to happen. And I called a couple times to check on the case and was essentially told that they're having a hard time finding evidence and that it would be great if we could go and find the evidence for them. Because after all, it is our case. It isn't their case. Those were the exact words.
That's awful. That's crazy.
Yeah. So this is my first interaction with a woman named Greer at the attorney general's office. So I was pretty angry then. But I just decided, okay, I'll just, maybe I can hire a private investigator. And so this former cop from Albuquerque came, reached out to me after seeing me on Kindle Ray and said, hey, I can probably help you. I'm retired. I can help look into the case and all this stuff. I'm like, that's great, because they're asking me to look for evidence and I don't even know where to start. She's like, okay, well, leave it to me. So she calls and she's like, oh, reading the case file. Oh yeah, I know this person. I know that person. I know this person. One thing that we had learned as I started, I'm all over the place. I'm so sorry, but like, I didn't even talk about how I talked about Jacob's case for the first time on True Consequences. But what you hear in that interview with my mom is the first time we've ever talked about it. And during that, building that episode series out, I had requested the records from the 2005 investigation because we didn't have them yet. And that's when we learned a bunch of stuff. That's when we learned that Stephen confessed twice. We don't know what he confessed to. We don't know what he said. We don't know what the circumstances were under that confession. All we have is a little note that says there's no need to administer a polygraph because the suspect confessed. So that was the first thing that we learned when we got this file. The second thing we learned was that polygraph that he took in Santa Fe, he failed. He did not pass that. So that
you were
was...
told by him that he did, correct?
Correct.
He came straight out boasting that he passed.
Correct. Correct. And there's two questions that he failed. Let's see here. If I can find them. He even was questioned by the chief of police about his failure of this polygraph. All right, so there was one scheduled in April. That one didn't happen. And then it happened in July 9th. They recorded it, sound recorded in its entirety, and allegedly was available for transcription. Good grief, I can't find them. One of the questions was, did you intentionally hit Jacob on the head area? And he said no. And then they asked if he struck Jacob on the back, on his back, and he said no. So those two questions, he failed. But
that
anyway.
That was the one he told you he passed when
correct.
He came out.
Correct. I had to go back there because that police officer that was looking into the case, she knew one of the people who was confessed to, Patrick Apodaca, former police officer from Socorro, because he left the Socorro Police Department after this and went to Albuquerque, and she worked with him. He told her, the first thing he said when she talked to him was, I knew that they were going to cover it up.
Wow.
He said that the sheriff at the time had driven Stephen around for hours and hours so the state police couldn't find him to administer a polygraph, and that he knew because all of them were friends with Stephen, so he knew that they weren't going to do anything with the investigation. So we learned this, and then this former police officer ghosts us. Which is, weird. Okay. But we're still like, okay, maybe we can find a different private investigator. I don't know what to do. And then I get a call from our advocate at the attorney general's office asking for a meeting. And so we schedule a meeting in person on January 11th of this year. And they just say they're going to give a case update. That's it. I told them, like, is it going to be virtual? Is it going to be in person? They said, no, it needs to be in person. And we're like, okay, cool. My mom's car wasn't working, so I had to drive 75 miles to Socorro to pick her up, 75 miles back, and then 75 miles to drop her off, 75 miles back. So it wasn't like just an easy thing for us to do. So I, maybe naively, started to get my hopes up, thinking that they surely would not ask us to do all of this just to tell us no. But that is exactly what happened. So
that's amazing.
Yeah. And it gets even more incredible. as I continue to tell the story, and I apologize in advance for all of the F-bombs that are about to come out of my mouth, but
it's you're just, fine.
It's okay. Gotta, it's safe space.
It's gotta happen. It's gotta happen. So they're sitting, it's like my mom and I are here, the advocate is to my right, and then the two prosecutors and the investigator are across the table from us. And they're like giving this big preamble about how it's a really old case and there's a lot of problems with the case and there's a lot of stuff missing and all this stuff. And so I'm like, oh, cool. This is the direction we're going. Great. And they say, unfortunately, we couldn't overcome this medical issue, which is basically there's no way to know for sure if I caused the first injury. And there's no way to know for sure if the first injury is what caused Jacob's death or the second injury is what caused Jacob's death.
That's asinine.
Yeah.
So Greer is, we're really good prosecutors and we don't shy away from scary, difficult cases. That's not what this is at all. We know what we're doing here and we can't overcome this and blah, blah, blah. My mom and I start to yell at both of them, at all of them. I don't think they understood what we said. I don't think we understood what we said, but I do know the last thing I said to them was that the state of New Mexico is liable for any person that Stephen has hurt after Jacob died. And that'll never stop being true. And one of the prosecutors said, I know it sucks. And I said, no, John, it fucking sucks. Fucking sucks. I said, it fucking sucks that this guy gets to live free and you guys just get to be like, oh, whatever. And so anyway, we leave. As we're leaving, the advocate puts her hand on my shoulder and says, oh, and just so you know, we have this sculpture here in our waiting room. It's a tree and we're asking everyone to make their handprints in whatever, cast your handprint, put your loved one's name in it and hang it on the tree so we can show everyone that we're here for the community.
And that's that. So that was their reasoning for having you to come all that way.
I don't know if that was the reasoning, but I just feel like that should have been a follow-up email, not something that you say to me after you just told me.
After you just told me
you're not going to do anything. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just the
what do you with that? The way to handle that.
It's just tone deaf. It's just tone deaf.
Yeah.
It's really read the room, right? Just gave us the worst possible news that you could give us. And now you want me to show the community that you care? Fuck you.
Yeah. Because what you're saying is the exact demonstration of you not caring about your community.
Yeah. So At first, they said they did a thorough investigation. They assured me that they did everything that they could in their power to try to come to a different resolution, and there's nothing that they could do. And then they said, oh, and by the way, I don't know if you were aware, this was my first red flag, I don't know if you were aware that the DA's office burnt down in like 1991. And I said, yeah, I'm very aware of that, Greer. Thank you for reminding me. And obviously you guys are aware that Stephen had the keys to every building in the county, right? And they were like,
what a surprise.
And I was like, look, I gave you guys his pay stub in the case file that I gave to you. It's not like you had to dig that hard to see his job and see where he worked. You could put that together yourself if you would have tried. So that was my first red flag. I'm like, okay, guess they didn't do that great of an investigation. So I immediately requested the records on the investigation. I asked for every interview transcript or recording that they could provide. I wanted all of the reports and supplemental reports related to the investigation. I wanted to know who they talked to, when they talked to them, and what they said. And they came back a couple weeks later with three documents from the hospital that didn't tell me anything that I didn't already know. And they said in the reply was like, if you agree with this, we'll consider this matter closed.
What?
And I said, I actually don't agree with it. This is not what I asked for. This has nothing to do with what I asked for. I said, so I'll just make it extra clear for you again. I need to know who you talked to, when you talked to them, and what they said. So another couple of weeks go by, and then they send me a 4-page document that is supposed to be the investigator's notes. So many things are wrong just in his summation that he wrote out. Like, the gender of the investigator that told my mom that she was alibying Steven, just a bunch of things, like facts that were not right. And I know it seems like I'm nitpicking, but like, these details, if you don't care about these details, then you don't care about any of the details.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
Exactly.
And what I saw in that document was that this investigator talked to one doctor in 3.5 years. That is their thorough investigation that they did on Jacob's case.
That's maddening.
I was beyond angry. And so I wrote back to them and I'm like, I need you to clarify for me if what I'm reading and what I'm seeing is accurate. Because it looks to me like your thorough investigation consisted of talking to one person and summarizing badly the case file that I gave you. So help me understand, like, how this is considered a thorough investigation. What I got back was, we've already told you that we didn't find any evidence. We're not going to try. And also, your mom alibying Steven is why we're not able to do anything.
And that still kills me that they're using the term alibi for a statement that was made. She didn't say, I saw him not hurt him. She didn't say that.
Yeah, she said, I don't think that he's capable.
And the other frustrating part is they're going back to someone that admitted. So Steven admitted multiple times that he did this.
Mm-hmm.
And then they go back and still try to say that it could have been caused by an injury caused by you.
Yeah.
That Steven said and was the only person that said that you did it.
My grandmother started to say that I was jealous and I was hitting Jacob too. So there is some corroboration of me being jealous. And I'm sure that I was to a certain extent. I just don't think I had the strength to injure Jacob. He had a broken rib.
Yeah, like, absolutely not.
You know what I mean?
And you weren't in the same state as him when it happened. That's also a very big part of it, too.
It's a huge part of it. But
it would be different if that stuff had happened, you left, and nothing happened after that.
Right.
Then it's okay. Maybe there was some jealousy. Maybe there were some issues. But you left, you were away, and these things still continued to happen that were documented that were happening.
Yep.
So
for me, when I hear them blaming my mom for why they're not going forward with any kind of investigation, I got very angry, as you can imagine.
Absolutely.
And I put in a records request for her alibi. I said, if this is what you're hanging your refusal to investigate this case on, then I want to see it. I want to see it in writing and signed by my mom. There's no possible way she could have alibied him. So I put that records request in, and then a couple days later, I get a call from Maria Madrid, your family advocate here at the Attorney General's office. And she was just calling to check in on how I'm doing. I let her know how I was doing. I said that it's a complete slap in the face that they thought that they could just do a half-ass investigation and that we were going to shut up and not say anything about it. I said that it's ridiculous to blame my mom for their ineptitude and their unwillingness to actually conduct an investigation on this case, which is what they promised to do. That's when Greer, who happens to be on the phone, jumps in and says, "Hi, Eric. Actually, that's why we're calling. It's because I really want to just make this very clear to you so that you understand where I'm coming from." She's like, "When I talk about an alibi, I'm talking about how there was doubt about you hurting Jacob." I said, "Okay. And in what world is that considered an alibi?"
Yeah.
And her response?
her response was like, I've been a prosecutor for a very long time, and I can tell when a case is winnable and when a case is not. And there's just things that we can't overcome, evidentiary issues that we can't overcome. And, you know, you should just believe me that I know what I'm doing. And I said, Greer, just because you've been a prosecutor for a long time doesn't mean you're any fucking good at it. You could be a terrible prosecutor for a long time. I know how hard it is to get fired from the state.
She obviously has no people skills.
And she says, and I said, and you know what? At least Hector Baldetas had the balls to show up and talk to us face to face. And she's like, I don't think that's very fair of you. And I said, really? There's a lot of that going on, Greer. So I guess we're even. And she says, it's really unfortunate that we couldn't come to a different conclusion. I said, yeah, you know what else is unfortunate, Greer? Getting fucking molested. And she like stopped for a second and she's like, that's just horrific. I'm like, I know, too bad nobody gives a fuck. So I'm just like going in on them. And I said, I don't understand why you didn't think that it was necessary for you to talk to Steven. This fucker has confessed twice. You didn't think that it was worth it to just apply the tiniest bit of pressure to him to see if he's going to fucking confess again. And maybe he would sign whatever fucking paper you put in front of him. But no, you don't see any evidentiary value in that. I'm sorry. That's just fucking lazy. It's just lazy.
And her response was,
I've been a prosecutor for so long. I said, yeah, you know what, Greer? I'm sick of prosecutors trying cases in their heads.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, and she doesn't know. That's the whole thing, is that it's not her job to determine the outcome of it. If it goes to trial and then a jury is going to look at it, and honestly, he would probably plead guilty if it went.
He's a fucking pussy, man. Like, this guy hits kids and women.
So let's get on that topic just for a second. So Steven's here, 3 years, the abuse and everything with you guys. Your mom and you left and he stalked you guys. What happened to him? Where has he been for the last 25 years? What's his life been like?
37 years.
37 years. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. He's right now he's running. Right now he's, nobody knows where he is. He boarded up his house that he inherited from his parents, and his family doesn't know where he's at. So he's hiding right now. But he's been able to do God knows what to God knows who for the last almost 4 decades. And I ended that conversation by telling Greer that I hope that I don't talk to you ever again. But if I do talk to you, it's when I and my private investigator bring all of the evidence to you on a silver fucking platter. And hopefully then you decide to do your fucking job. And then I said, does that make sense to you, Greer? Am I being clear to you? So I'm done. Like, I'm done playing nice. I try to play nice. I am a fucking fierce fighter when it comes to my family. Like, I will not back down. And they have only emboldened me to continue and to get louder and to start going after the entire state of New Mexico, because the entire state of New Mexico is responsible, not just for what happened to Jacob, but for what happened to me. And for what happened to my mom, and for what happened to anybody else who's been hurt by Steven. And if there's anybody listening right now who has been hurt by Richard Steven Chavez from Socorro, New Mexico, or Silver City, reach out to me, because I'll fight with you to get justice.
Because I guarantee you, he just didn't leave you guys' life and become a different person. He's been doing the same thing for 37 years.
Yep.
To whoever he's involved with. He had a pattern, he did it, and he's continuing to do it. He's probably still doing it as we speak.
Yep. Yep. So that's where the case is. That's why I'm trying to put pressure on the Attorney General to do an actual investigation. That's why I'm doing the 10 Days of Jacob. That's why I'm setting up the petition. That's why I'm doing all this push for media. I think another thing that could really help us is if people could request that big media outlets cover Jacob's story. The more pressure we can put on Raul, the more likely he is to do the right thing. He cares about being elected. And if we can make him feel that pressure, he will do what he needs to do to investigate this case.
Absolutely. And that's what we'll start sharing. And like I said, when we'll get this episode teed up, we're going to want to release it on the 10th, but we will get this teed up before the 1st so we can start getting people to participate and we're going to start pushing hard for you.
Thank you, guys.
Absolutely. I know it
takes, I know it takes a lot, and yeah, we appreciate you sharing your story. And I know that it's something that you have to, you live with it every day, but then you're doing this, and it's admirable that you're bringing this, not even so much, you're bringing the trauma back into your life every time you talk about it. So I know that's not easy, and we appreciate you sharing it with us and with your, with our family and our people.
Yeah.
I appreciate you guys allowing me to share Jacob's story here. It means so much. My mom and I are so grateful to everybody who's done that, who's helped us, because without you guys, we wouldn't be where we are, and we wouldn't feel as confident as we do that we can put the amount of pressure that's needed on this situation to make it have a better outcome.
We're going to get it there. Absolutely. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. We're in your corner.
Thank you guys.
Yes. Eric, thank you for joining us. We appreciate you very much. We're going to be very active in this. We're going to see you soon at a couple different places and get to hang out again. And hopefully this will be, when we're looking at this by Advocacy Con next year, it'll be a totally different story that we're telling when we're there.
That'd be awesome.
That'd be great. Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Broken System Podcast. We hope you found our discussion thought-provoking and engaging.
If you enjoy what you hear and want to support the show, please consider joining our Patreon community. You can find us at patreon.com/thebrokensystempodcast. Your contributions help keep the podcast running and allow us to bring you more insightful content.
Don't forget to connect with us on social media. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram to stay updated on upcoming episodes, behind-the-scenes content, and more. You can find us on all by searching The Broken System Podcast.
And finally, if you love what we do, please take a moment to leave a 5-star review on your favorite podcast platform. Your reviews not only make our day, but they also help others discover the podcast.
Thank you once again for your support. Together, we can continue to challenge the broken systems around us and strive for positive change. Until next time, take care and stay tuned.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.